netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hi, welcome to FX Guide. I'm Mike Seymour. So, what we're about to listen to is an interview recorded about a week ago with Stu Mashowitz from The Orphanage with John Montgomery. Stu and John are both After Effects users, but Stu is actually one of the founders of The Orphanage, and he's been absolutely a leading light in the After Effects community in things such as doing film pipelines using After Effects. He was behind Elin, for example, which is a tool that's been used prior to version 7 for doing logarithmic and Cineon files in a linear color space. But with version 7 of After Effects, they've actually been able to develop a full 32-bit pipeline. Stu's one of the pioneers in this area, and he actually sits down with John Montgomery, and they go through some of the main sort of steps that you would need to address when looking at doing a 32-bit pipe. So, for example, they start with color management. This is a new thing, and so they look at some of the gotchas and some of the things to watch out for, as well as what's good about the implementation in After Effects 7. And then they discuss setting up a linear floating point workflow inside this color management system. They also discuss tips for importing imagery into this 32-bit sort of pipeline, how to use, for example, camera raw files or OpenEXR imagery. And also some of the caveats for working with 32-bit float. You know, things to watch out for, how to deal with 8 and 16-bit filters in a 32-bit workspace. And finally, they give you some really good tips in how to get the most of your imagery and how to get your imagery out of After Effects when it's done. So, over now to John, who recorded this interview a few days ago in Chicago.
Thanks, Mike. I've got Stu on the line. Stu, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Before we begin, why don't we get a little bit about your history? I know you kind of started taking interest in the Macintosh platform back in your days at ILM with John Knoll. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I was a technical director and compositor, kind of in the traditional sense, at Industrial Light and Magic, back in the days of Twister and the first Mission Impossible film. And it was on that Mission Impossible movie that I got to sort of look over the shoulder of John Knoll, who was our visual effects supervisor, who was doing a couple shots for the re-release of Star Wars on his beige Mac. And he was using Electric Image, and I think he was on After Effects version 2 or 3. And it just looked to me like he was having an incredible amount of fun doing what was at the time regarded as a pretty technical thing. He was treating it in a much more kind of artistic way. And so the two of us kind of decided that we could actually try to do this on a larger scale for more shots in movies that had that type of effects work in it. So we started a group inside of ILM called the Rebel Mac Unit. And this group somewhat notoriously used, you know, off-the-shelf hardware and software to do ILM quality visual effects, which is now doesn't sound like a crazy idea at all, but at the time it was viewed as a little bit of a nutty thing to do, I guess, hence the term rebel in the name of the group.
So you went there. What happened after? Where'd you go after ILM?
Well, I kind of met up with a couple other people with similar ideas about this kind of accessibility of high-end visual effects work, and another thing that was happening at the time was that Sony had released their first digital video cameras, the DV kind of revolution was starting, and we saw that as this amazing collision. And so myself and John Rothbard and Scott Stewart left ILM and started a company called The Orphanage with the goal of not just being a visual effects fee-for-service business, but also being a production company that would use these digital tools to make our own films.
You not only use those kind of tools, but you do use other forms of composite, not just After Effects
right,
and the desktop.
Right. But yeah, I think the best thing, you know, I mean, we have this great relationship with Adobe, obviously, that began back in those Rebel Mac days, and that we've managed to keep even more lively now that we're our own company and we control our ability to handle, you know, to just basically have these great technology relationships. But yeah, I feel like the best thing I can do for Adobe is to not only use their software, but to also, you know, for instance, use Digital Fusion, which we have and we like quite a bit. If it weren't maybe for our having access to Digital Fusion and to Shake and to some other options out there, we may never have pushed Adobe as hard as we did for them to add the 32-bit floating point mode into After Effects 7.
And to kind of give us a perspective on that kind of giant leap for the product, maybe you could take us just through a real brief look at how you would deal with working with film imagery and higher bit depth stuff in After Effects 6.5 and earlier. I mean, how did you work around the fact it wasn't a 32-bit product?
Yeah, so I think maybe what I'd like to do is just take one step back and just kind of talk about why we even bothered trying to do this high-end kind of compositing work in a program like After Effects, because I think a lot of people think we're kind of crazy for doing
right.
that. And the truth is that I'm a fairly technical person, but coming from a place like ILM where you really, at least at the time, things have changed a lot since then, but you really had to be a mere computer scientist level of brain in order to just put a picture up on the screen there. And what got me excited about After Effects was that I was seeing a tool that was looking at the problem of compositing images as a strictly creative one. And obviously there's always technical things, but I come from a more sort of traditional filmmaking background where you're constantly kind of blending the technical and the artistic back and forth. And After Effects just seemed like a filmmaker's tool in the truest sense. So when it came time to develop our own pipeline at the Orphanage, we based it around After Effects, certainly because that's what we were familiar with, but I think we also maintained that philosophy that compositing should be a really creative part. I think much more the kind of the way a flame artist looks at things. It's really a creative thing. It's an opportunity not just to put the elements of the shot together and make sure they all match up, but to really imbue the shot with the things about it that really make it sing. So we did that, and we did that up until the point where we worked on our first feature film that had, a traditional Cineon input and output pipeline, and then we were stuck with the problem that a lot of After Effects users face, which is how to do that, how to work that pipeline in a responsible way. And what a lot of people are doing out there, and people are still doing this, and they're doing this in Flames, and they're doing this in Shake, but they're certainly doing it in After Effects, is compositing directly in the log color space of the Cineon scans. And we tried that on one show and we just hated it. We just thought, this isn't working, nothing that we are doing seems to make any sense, and it's just way too easy to make ugly looking images this way. So we developed a tool called Elin that is basically a way of kind of mimicking a linear color space and mildly overbright, respectful color space inside of After Effects 16-bit color mode.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we've been using ever since then. We've run a huge number of shots, hundreds and hundreds of shots, through an Elin pipeline in 16-bit color space in After Effects 6.5 and even earlier versions.
Obviously, then the new version was a welcome dish. I'm sure you were pushing for that through your contacts at Adobe.
Part of the deal with Elin, and part of the reason that we made it public, we were kind of using it as an internal tool, and it was kind of a way that we could scare the living bejesus out of new compositors coming into the facility, because they'd look at this weird thing that we were doing where we were applying these kind of color space effects to every element on the way in and then to the entire comp on the way out. And it's like, taking the already difficult job of compositing and adding this extra level of complexity to it. So we thought, well, if we release this thing publicly, we can have two enormous positive outcomes to come from that. One is that we could actually expect maybe that someone would be familiar with it when they're coming to apply for a job at the Orphanage, but also we can actually use it to kind of generate interest in the After Effects community for this kind of pseudo floating point compositing technique. And then we might have more than just our puny voice shouting at the giant gates of Adobe saying, please add floating point.
Yeah. And I think also just even motion graphic designers will actually find a lot, of benefit from creating graphics in the 32-bit composition as well. There are really nice blending things that happen when you're dealing with that kind of color space or bit depth, excuse me.
I agree completely, and I think that's been a part of the advocacy that I've, you know, tried to exhibit on my blog for Floating Point, is not that you should use it for technical reasons, but that you should use it for creative reasons, and that even people who aren't working with film scans or with EXR renders can benefit greatly from a 32-bit workflow.
Definitely, I definitely agree. But this change in the 32-bit workflow can, not really two parts of it, but we can take a look at two changes that really help this, and that's the support for 32-bit float as well as new color management features. The color management being what I consider, and I think from reading your comments, is kind of the first rev of color management.
Absolutely.
Why don't we talk a little bit about that? Because I know a ton of artists, even including myself at times, turn off color management in the Adobe apps. Because admittedly, you know, they seem to be confusing and impact my imagery in weird ways. Why should I be using color management in the apps? First off,
well, I think it's legitimate that we've all kind of shied away from it in the past and tried to find weird ways of, you know, disabling it in or effectively disabling it in Photoshop, because not all in the film industry, not all of our applications are ICC color space aware, and so it's far better for us to have our images look consistent from application to application than for them to look, according to Hoyle, correct in one application if that's not how they look in our compositing program, you know. And I think that's been kind of the antipathy that's existed towards color management, is that the Photoshop perspective is this is the right way to do it and you all should be doing it, but the film industry has been a little slow to tag along on that, and for good reason, not the least of which has been that ICC profiles didn't traditionally support floating point. So, at least now with if you're a person who uses After Effects and Photoshop together, which I think is a pretty popular combination, at least now you can somewhat responsibly use ICC color management in After Effects and use it together with Photoshop and get pretty predictable results. The simplest possible example of how a person might just take advantage of color management in After Effects 7 would just be that if they're working for output to NTSC video, and they could go into a project that they had created in 6.5, load it into 7, and just assign a project working color space of SympDC. And nothing would change about their project except that their views would be display corrected to sort of try to transform the primaries, the assumed primaries of SympDC, to the color primaries of their calibrated monitor. And that should make, you know, your cinema display or your CRT monitor look a lot more like your, you know, Sony BVM that's been carefully calibrated in the traditional video kind of color bars kind of way. So there's kind of an easy way to just, you know, flick it on and make it and turn it on in a way that's appropriate for your workflow without even getting into some of the uncomfortable kludginess that exists if you want to try to emulate a fully color-managed workflow. But unfortunately, for those of us who want to work in linear or for those of us working with film, we've got to dive deeper and get into those kind of kludgy solutions that hopefully will be improved in future versions.
Right. So the first step, if someone's going to, I mean, we'll start with the NTSC example. If they're going to want to use color management, the first thing is to get their display calibrated at least the level that's included within the system profile.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then turn on the project profile setting. Now, when you bring footage in, however, what's kind of confusing is, unlike Photoshop and other things, when you bring import footage that has an ICC profile on it, nothing actually happens by default in After Effects.
That's correct. Yeah. So basically, there's no way to talk about this that isn't confusing, but the safest thing to say is that any footage you import is assumed to be in the working space. Another way of putting it is, just like you said, nothing is done to it on the way in. So when you define a project working space, all you're defining is how your stuff is going to be viewed. If you want to convert something from one color space to another, like for instance, if your client has handed you their logo and they've said this logo is tagged with the Adobe RGB profile, then what there is there's an effect that's grouped under the utility effects called the color profile converter. And you would apply that to the footage, and you would set the input profile to the profile that the image is stored in, which would be, in this case, Adobe RGB. And you could set the output to the project working space. And that way, whatever project working space you have, the logo will automatically be converted to that. So in our example, it would be Simply C. And then you've correctly converted the colors of the logo into the video color space, which is a very handy thing to be able to do. You know, the obvious thing that one would prefer would be that After Effects would recognize that this image is tagged and convert it on import, you know.
So let's say you're setting up for a film pipeline in 32-bit workflow. How does that setup differ from, say, an NTSC workflow?
Well, there's a really amazingly powerful film pipeline that is possible in After Effects 7. However, it's a little bit limited right out of the gate. Why don't I take a step back and actually just kind of describe what this workflow is? So if you just, for instance, had, you know, your Cineon file, you would create a new project, you would assign a project working space, you would import the Cineon footage, and then you would assign it this color negative profile. And what you're doing then basically is you're having After Effects convert you're having it basically strip out the characteristic curve of the film, which is a very powerful and cool thing to be able to do. And it took a lot of cooperation between, you know, Adobe and ICC, and you know, just, I mean, it's kind of an amazing confluence of efforts that made this simple thing possible. Now, what's really cool about this is that, you know, this will convert your film neg into any color space, but what's, of course, my personal thing, the thing I'm most excited about is the possibility of converting it into a linear floating point color space. And in order to do that, of course, you need to have a linear profile and a linear color space as your working space, there are no linear color profiles that ship with the application, so you have to build your own or download them from my blog.
Right, which, of course, we'll have a link to that in our online story as well.
I've published a couple just simple, you know, Gamma 1.0 color profiles with a couple different primaries, and if you have one of those as your project working space, and you set your project to 32 bits per channel, and you go into the more options, you can actually convert your footage, and the neg stock, it turns out, is 5218. So you can actually assign your footage the profile of 5218, and if it happens to be that profile, when you now look at it, you're looking at scene referred and profiled linear color values, which is a mouthful, but it's an extremely cool thing. For instance, if you load up Kodak's Marcy Digital Lad image and assign it this profile, you're actually looking, according to the math that's been published for what this film stock's all about, you're actually looking at what Marcy looked like there on that day that she was photographed, which is kind of creepy and weird. But of course, that's not particularly useful to you either. That's not what you want to do. But what you want to do is you want to see what Marcy's going to look like when she's shot back out to a print stock. And so with that view selected, if you go to the view menu and go to proof setup, you'll see an option for Kodak 2383 Theater, which I believe is Kodak's Vision print stock. And if you select that as your proof setup and turn proof colors on, now you really have the holy grail. You've got Marcy in linear floating point color space with the overbrights in her hair, occupying the overbright range and doing what light ought to do, but you're viewing her as she will appear when she is filmed out to Kodak Vision print stock. And that's pretty cool. That's an end-to-end, film calibration pipeline that doesn't require you to have anything more expensive at your facility than, just a regular old, traditional kind of ICC hockey puck, monitor calibration system.
Well, that's, yeah, that's, I found it interesting that, first off, the lack of the linear profile that shifts with After Effects, and then in talking to Dave Simons and Steve, that decided just opened up too many cans of worms, potentially, in providing that.
Yeah. And I think that's really true. I mean, it's, you know, you can look to Photoshop as an example of an application that tried to kind of enforce linear color space for all 32-bit work. Mm-hmm. You know, while it may be kind of forcing you to educate yourself or forcing you to do certain things right, it's also, man, it just makes things just, they can be just as confusing, you know? and I think an application like After Effects cannot afford to be that, I don't know what the term would be, but it can't really afford to kind of enforce a particular workflow on people. It's far better, I think, that they did what they did, which is just kind of provide the hooks for people to work in the color space that they want. One thing I think that was really important for them when they added 32-bit, and I really empathize with this, is that they wanted people to just take an existing project and be able to just switch it into 32-bit and see what happened.
Right.
Because it's not the same thing, of course, as going from 8 to 16-bit. You can't just, you know, when you go from 8 to 16-bit, all you're going to get is better. You know, nothing's going to change except that if you had any banding issues or whatever, they should go away. But going, switching into 32-bit, you could see some really weird things could happen. If you had a bunch of layers that were getting really bright and then you did something later to them that made them dark, they're going to look considerably different when you switch them into 32-bit. Hopefully better, but if you liked the way things looked before, you might be surprised at how they look now, you know?
Yeah, and what actually, that's a good point, and what pitfalls can you get into actually when you're working in linear workspace and linear space?
Yeah.
What do you have to watch out for? Because then there are, you know, certain transfer modes that don't work and so forth.
Yeah, absolutely. I really felt like when I started working in linear float that I was relearning everything that I ever knew about compositing. And I kind of considered myself to be a bit of an expert compositor, and all of a sudden it was just like I was back to square one, you know, which to me was an exciting thing. It felt like new stuff to learn, but I think, you know, not everybody looks at it.
It's a learning process for sure, yeah.
It definitely is, you know. You know, the simplest thing would just be that in Clamp's color space, one of our favorite transfer modes has always been screen. Screen is just a really beautiful way of kind of simulating an overexposure. It looks really elegant. Things don't blow out and clamp the way they do with the add transfer mode. And you can't use screen and float. I mean, you can, but you're going to really be surprised at what happens when you screen two really bright things together. If you screen something bright over something neutral, it's actually, if you screen an overbright pixel over a neutral pixel, you're actually going to darken that pixel. And that's not at all what you'd expect. So that's a case of, you know, screen is basically kind of a cheat that that works really well in a gamma encoded space. But as you begin to dive into this linear floating point thing, you realize that actually the simplest solution once again becomes the best solution. And in fact, to simulate a double exposure, you're far better off just using add. And in gamma encoded clipped space, add looks really ugly and blows out really quickly. But in linear floating point, add is a really elegant, beautiful looking blend. And the same is true of multiply. Multiply becomes extremely useful because multiply can be used to both brighten and darken things. And so it still has all its traditional applications, although it, again, looks sort of gentler and more lovely in linear color space. But you can also multiply a bright pixel over an image and actually brighten it up. So the way we kind of talk about it here at the Orphanage, when we're trying to indoctrinate people into these new ways, is that add is the new screen, mm-hmm. and multiply is the new hard light.
Yeah, try it again for the first time.
Yeah, it's definitely true. There's so many ways that you can get tripped up, but what you always find, I think, is that after you get tripped up and after you unlearn your old ways, you realize that actually it's simpler, it's actually more elegant, and that the things we used to do to kind of cheat, you know, and try to, like, give the effects of light blooming and whatever, you actually just get it all for free. So once you kind of absorb the idea that you're going to have to relearn some techniques, you actually wind up, you're able to create a much more efficient composite. You have to cheat less.
Yeah, it's actually also kind of interesting. I was thinking about this the other day, that After Effects now actually provides an affordable, I mean, it's not a cheap product, but it's relatively affordable to actually introduce the type of workflow to way more people and learn about as well. Because prior to that, you'd have to spend a considerable amount of money to even begin kind of dealing with learning how to work in 32-bit float.
That is true, and that is something that I think, that's kind of the mission of my blog, is to try to kind of, I don't know, to try to, back at the Rebel Mac unit, we had an unpopular sort of unofficial motto, which is you don't have to be that much of a nerd to do this stuff, and and there's certainly some extremely nerdy things on my blog, but the idea, at least, is to also keep things focused on why creatively you should be doing this stuff as opposed to technically. Because I had people coming up and telling me, you guys should be working in floating point, man, because you can hold detail, you know, in dark shadows and on the surface of the sun. And I just thought, when am I going to need to, like, you know, hold detail on the surface of the sun? I didn't have any idea why I wanted that. But as soon as someone showed me what motion blur looked like in front of a blown out sky that actually had detail in it, and how that motion blur wound up having that kind of cool blue saturation that it was actually picking up because it was acting like a neutral density filter on a sky that to my eye had been already blown out to white, I was like sold. I was like, oh my God, that is, you know, that I used to think what made me a good compositor is I knew all these tricks to fake in all of these principles of photography and light, and now they just come for free with float. So now what makes me a good compositor is that I actually make good-looking shots, you know?
Exactly. Well, that's a good segue into what we want to talk about next, because, you know, maybe 15 minutes on color management is kind of geeky, admittedly, but we like that.
Yeah.
But in addition to that stuff, I mean, there are a lot of benefits to working in the 32-bit workflow. I mean, there's a lot of people, as you mentioned, still doing work in 12-bit and even 8-bit, but we've done quite a few stories on our site about kind of pushing HDR in the 32-bit float workflow. What, from a creative standpoint, do you gain by working in 32-bit? You mentioned kind of stuff of maintaining highlights and shadows, and the motion blur stuff is great, but what else is great?
You know, the main thing is that by kind of doing things right, you level the playing field of just the conversation. You can use very photographic terms in your compositing workflow. So if you want to, if your client is more film language savvy than computer language savvy, they might say something like, you know, hey, make that thing over there a stop brighter or a stop darker. And it's only in a linear color space that you can responsibly do that, you know. And of course, After Effects has like a really great exposure effect that when you apply it, it actually has a little checkbox in it that says bypass linear conversion. It's assuming that you're going to apply it to a non-linear image. It's assuming you're going to apply it to a gamma encoded image, because they certainly know that the vast majority of the customers are going to do it that way. But for us working in linear, we can uncheck that, and then we have a proper exposure tool. And if you have a linear color space, you don't even need to uncheck it, because it's aware of whether or not it needs to presume that you're working in a gamma-encoded space. So it's a great way to kind of draw the traditional photography world and cinematography world closer to the nerdy world of visual effects.
Right. And you know, one of the nerdiest areas of that is also 3D, which is, you know, compositing when, with 3D outputs at the higher bit depth is just fantastic as well.
Yeah, that to me is probably the most exciting, because that's the easiest way for a person to get high dynamic range imagery into their compositing applications, to get it out of their 3D application. And you know, I just finished a commercial for a restaurant chain called Ruby Tuesday, where we had a bunch of computer generated Mini Coopers racing across a bar, and you know, I shot that in a soundstage in LA, and we got obviously our, you know, full HDR environment capture of that set with all the people on it and all the lighting. And we were able to use director of photography John Stanier's amazing, you know, on-set lighting to light our computer-generated Mini Coopers. And, you know, so these Minis are racing down the bar, and they've got highlights on them that, you know, on a scale of 0 to 1, 1 being white, these highlights are 20, 30, 40, 50, and their headlights are turned on, and their headlights are returning values up to, like, 300. And so when those things motion blur by, you know, they create this incredibly photographic streak, you know, and then of course we take that into After Effects 7, and now we've got we preserve all of that good stuff. And if we just add the tiniest little glow or the tiniest little flare effect on top of that, it pops off of the crazy bright highlights and ignores the rest of the image. And an incredibly, you know, complex and interesting thing happens, which is that, you know, what looks like a totally blown out headlight right in your face actually has all these cool little interplays of light because the compositing effects that you're doing are responding to pixel values that are off the charts, you know. So really, really simple things produce really beautiful and very photographic results in Linear Float.
Yeah, it really, really, really opens up a whole new, much more optical way of compositing.
Yeah, absolutely. And that can be true for, like you're saying, that can be true for elements that you create directly inside of After Effects as well. You know, you just, you know, you make some text, you crank its exposure up 5 stops and put a little blur on it, and you've got an instant glowy effect that, you know, would have taken you 10 layers to right. create any other way, you know.
Let's talk about real quickly actually using footage in a 32-bit project. There's some new file formats that are supported, including Camera Raw and OpenEXR. Why don't you talk a little bit about those and some caveats, actually, of using OpenEXR as well?
Sure. Well, like I think Dave mentioned when he was on the podcast, you can bring in Camera Raw, and it won't come in directly Float, but it's actually a good way to get imagery into a floating point space because Camera Raw has an exposure slider in it. So the trick that I learned from some guys with the Inside Track at Adobe is that if you take the brightness and the contrast and the black level and just zero them all out in Camera Raw and then just set the exposure to the point where you're not clipping anything, you might wind up with an image that looks pretty dark. But effectively, you've kind of stripped out all the oh, and you have to linearize the contrast curve as well. And then you've kind of stripped out all the tone munging that Camera Raw is so good at doing, and you've created an image that you can then use the color profile converter to convert into your linear project working space. And then you can expose it back up, and you've effectively made an HDR image out of one exposure of a raw capture. So that's pretty cool. I know a lot of people out there who are doing kind of stop motion film pipelines using digital SLRs as their taking camera, and the ability to import a sequence of Camera Raw files and treat them in this way, I think, is going to be a huge boon to that extremely cool kind of blend of old school and new school workflow. Yes, you can now load EXR files and HDR.HDR files into After Effects as well as floating point TIFFs. And that's an area where if you are working with a linear color profile and if you are working with, if your 3D pipeline is linear as well, which therefore assumes that it has some kind of gamma display correction going on, then everything should work fine. The trip up might happen for people who are kind of working with EXRs that might be coming from a variety of different sources. Adobe, you know, read up on the spec of EXRs and learned that they're, you know, supposed to be stored in a linear color space. And so they will assume that it is. But I think there are a lot of people out there who are rendering EXRs into effectively a gamma encoded color space because they're not using any display correction in their 3D software. And so these people are getting very confused about what was happening to their images when they're loading into After Effects. So there is a little checkbox inside the project settings that kind of governs how this works. And this is only a checkbox that's valid if you're not working with a linear project working space. And that checkbox is called Import Output 32-Bit Per Channel Format as Linear Light. And there's about a paragraph of text underneath it that changes depending on whether you turn it on or off. And basically, with it on, if you take a linear EXR and load it into a default, you know, 8-bit After Effects project, it's going to look right, which means that it's going to have been gamma corrected on import. If your EXR file isn't linear, if it's already gamma encoded, which technically speaking is a no-no, but there's probably more gamma-encoded EXRs out there than any of us want to admit. So you load it in, it's going to look double gammaed, and you're going to freak out. Just go into project settings and turn off this checkbox, and everything will look fine.
Great tip. Not every effect in After Effects is 32-bit. Of course, we kind of covered that in our online story, and you have 16 and 8-bit varieties. But there are several options for converting before applying these effects if you have to. There are probably obviously some places that you want to place these in your comp, and so maybe you're only converting them once. Why don't you talk about dealing with converting stuff that you can use then for 16 and 8-bit if you have to, things like the HDR compander and things like that.
Yeah, so now we're getting into a territory where this is the price that you're going to pay for being an early adopter. You know, what you've got in After Effects 7 is a little bit of float and a little bit of color management. And if you want to use a lot of float or a lot of color management, you're going to have to be willing to do some work. And we talked about the work that was required for the color management, and now we'll talk about the work that's required for the float. So, yes, you can apply a 16 or 8-bit per channel effect directly to a layer inside a float project. And it's worth mentioning that in After Effects 7, the entire project is float. So it's not like some other applications where you can kind of work in 8-bit and then bump things up to float and do some float and then add a node that, you know, changes the bit depth back down to 8 or 16-bit to do some other stuff. Once you've made the commitment to float in a project, all your buffers are stored in float. But if you apply an effect that isn't float-aware, then you will only be applying it to the values between 0 and 1. The After Effects will just chop off everything above 1 and hand that to the effect. The effect will do its thing, and it'll hand you back a low dynamic range result. So it's a little treacherous right now because the vast majority of our effects are not float yet. And so it's so easy, right in the middle of a, you know, big, expensive compositing session that has all kinds of lovely overbrights, to just drop an effect in somewhere and then lop off all your overbrights,
right.
and then only discover that later when you're trying to do something that utilizes the overbrights, and you're like, oh great, where did I go wrong? I mean, even just the levels effect, which is our most common color correction effect, defaults for backwards compatibility to having its whites clipped. So every time you apply levels, which is probably the most common effect that we apply, we have to remember to go in there and turn that little checkbox off. We've actually created an effects, you know, an animation preset that we use that's just unclipped levels, and we just are trying to get in the habit of using that instead of actually reaching for the effects menu. So yeah, like you were saying, the smart thing to do would be, if you have some 8 or 16-bit things that you need to do, is to do it, if this makes sense for you, is to do it while your footage is still effectively LDR, you know. Mm-hmm. So if you import some video footage that by its very nature isn't going to have overbrights, you know, if you want to apply grain surgery to it, which is not float yet, that's the time to do it. Even if then you're going to subsequently brighten it up and push its overbrights through the roof, that'll be okay, you know. Similarly, if you're using a grid for some purpose, don't apply the grid effect directly to a HDR layer. Apply it to a solid, and then lay that grid, you know, transfer that solid over the the thing. The blend mode itself will still be float, and but if you apply it directly to the layer, it won't be.
So if you do, there are options. If you need to, you can convert your footage, or instead of just having it clipped or chopped off at 0 and 1, there are some tools for converting that. There's HDR compander. Is there only that, or are there other tools that give you more handles to trying to deal with that?
There's an effect called the HDR compander, and that effect is really far more useful if you use it via an animation preset that ships with the application. It's called compress and expand dynamic range, and that applies, like Dave was saying in the other podcast, it applies two sort of mated compander effects, one that compresses and one that expands. Mm-hmm. And And the effects, the sliders are actually really make sense the way they're laid out. This is an incredibly powerful effect, and it's the kind of thing that even when you're working in Shake or Fusion, you probably your facility probably has created macros to do exactly this. Like for instance, if you were working with 16-bit key light in Shake on top of a film footage in a float environment, you would need to do this. Basically, the gain slider in the first of the two effects is going to default to 1, and what you want to do is you want to set that value to the brightest value that you want to preserve. Mm-hmm. So basically, you just sort of start mousing over your image, and if you start mousing over, one of your film images, you might actually find values up to like 65, 70 in that film image, which is really cool. You know, in the traditional way of converting a Cineon file to linear using the prescribed Kodak methodology, the brightest value you're probably going to get out is something like between 13 and 14. But with this ICC method, you actually can get values up in the 60s and 70s, which is the result of unfolding the toe and shoulder of the film stock. And that's really cool. And that really does prove once and for all that film is an HDR capture medium. So you could set gain on the first of these effects to 70, and the gain on the second one will automatically match that. And then you can sandwich an LDR effect in between those two effects. And now all it's doing is it's just squishing the image down. It's turning 70 into 1 and turning everything else, scaling it along the way. And then you can squeeze a little effect in there. And the downside of that is that, you are trading overbright handling or you're trading image fidelity for overbright handling.
Right.
So as you scale the image up, you are throwing away your ability to resolve it, especially if that effect's going to be 16-bit. You can really, at a value of 70, you're certainly going to start seeing quantizing in the shadows if you're using a linear color space. So that's where the gamma slider comes in. You can then start scooting up the gamma slider to start trying to redistribute those 0 to 70 color values in a nonlinear way, so that you are putting more bits into the shadows and trying to remove the quantization. Of course, at the same time you're doing that, you're unlinearizing the color space, which means that if you're applying something like a blur effect, you're going to start to lose some of those lovely properties of the linear color space that was the whole reason you tried to do this float thing in the first place. So Compander is a great and important tool, but it is not a silver bullet,
Right, right. Well, and we'll just talk finally as our last part here about our output stage. What type of things we need to be aware of when we're working at an output stage? Because, you're working on 32-bit project for NTSC, maybe you're working on it for film. What do we need to be aware of?
Right, and so basically depending on which method you've chosen of kind of doing all this stuff, you can choose how you want to handle that output. If you just did the simple kind of color management thing of switching your project into giving your project a working space just so you had a view adjustment, you don't have to do anything on output. If you're working with a linear color profile as your project working space, then that same color profile converter effect that you used on import, you have to use it again on output. You'd set the input profile to be project working space and output profile to be sRGB or SIMTC or whatever it is that you started from. And that's how you'll real round trip things. And the same thing is true of the film workflow. You're going to have to convert things back from the linear, from the project working space to the color negative color space. And, the nice thing about this is you can always just write out a frame and just make sure that your input matches your output, and yes, you've safely round-tripped it, and then you know that when you add your dinosaur to the shot, that you've handed back a pristine image that where the only thing new about it is your visual effect. So that's again, these things can only get better from here, but right now it's sort of a manual process to maintain both color managed and then a safe kind of way of outputting this stuff inside the same project.
Well, fantastic. Well, thanks for the information. One thing I just also want to mention, as we're out of time here, but is your website. You talked about a little. I stumbled upon your website maybe 4 or 5 months ago. Why don't you give the URL and talk a little bit about what you cover on your site?
Sure. Yeah. The it's a blog, and it's ProLost. That's ProLost .blogspot.com, and that is the place where basically, if three people ask me a question, rather than email them all individually, I'll just put a post up about it, and I'm preemptively trying to assuage all of the many questions that I know are gonna flow in about the linear color workflow inside of After Effects. I think it's kind of the least I can do after badgering Adobe to to put in the features for this thing, to try to educate people about why they ought to be using them. So, but it's also a site where I kind of just cover some of my my filmmaking and commercial directing endeavors, as well as kind of highlight some of the technical stuff that's going on inside the walls of the orphanage. I'm always trying to kind of ride the line between it being too geeky and too technical, and too and yet, of course, I don't want it to be too bloggy and about, you know, what I had for breakfast and
right.
And my feelings about that. So,
well, it's a great
mix. I really love getting comments there, and you know, I hope people find the information useful.
Yeah, it is, and it's, again, it can, a lot of the information transcends applications as well, obviously, too. So it's actually a great resource. We'll have a link to that in our online stories, as well as some imagery to help illustrate some of the stuff we've talked about in this audio form.
Great.
For everybody. So, again, really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us and sharing your thoughts about the new workflow in After Effects.
Right on. Thanks a lot, John.
Well, thanks for listening to this week's FX Guide podcast. Actually, Stu has his own website with it's like a blog about After Effects stuff, but Stu's been kind enough to give us a whole bunch of tips, especially advanced stuff to do with 32-bit, and John's going to be rolling those out over the coming weeks. And certainly the whole site will be doing a bunch more on After Effects 7 in the coming months. If you've got any ideas for future podcasts you'd like to hear, we really do take your suggestions seriously. And in fact, many of the podcasts you've heard in the last couple of months have been the direct result of people sending in requests. Some of them we can't always accommodate because they're a bit obscure, but generally we really try and respond to what you guys are after. So thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next time. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2006 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide LLC.